It is with a great deal of pleasure that I introduce Justice Albie Sachs. I'll read a little bit of his bio from the website of the South African Constitutional Court. On turning six during World War II, Albie Sachs received a card from his father expressing the wish that he would grow up to be a soldier in the fight for liberation. His career in human rights activism started at the age of 17 when, as a second-year law student at the University of Cape Town, he took part in the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign. 3 years later, he attended the Congress of the People in Cliptown, where the Freedom Charter was adopted. He started practice as an advocate at the Cape Bar at age 21, where his work involved defending people charged under racist statutes and repressive security laws. Many faced the death sentence. He himself was raided by the security police, subjected to banning orders restricting his movement, and eventually placed in solitary confinement without trial for 2 prolonged spells of detention. And although it doesn't say it here, I know that Albie's prison diaries were so striking and well done they were produced as a play. In 1966, he went into exile. After spending 11 years studying and teaching law in England, he worked for a further 11 years in Mozambique as a law professor and legal researcher. In 1988, he was blown up by a bomb placed in his car in Maputo by South African security agents, losing an arm and the sight of an eye. During the 1980s, working closely with Oliver Tambo, leader of the African National Congress in exile, he helped draft the organization's code of conduct as well as its statutes. After recovering from the bomb, he devoted himself full-time to preparations for a new democratic constitution for South Africa. In 1990, he returned home to South Africa, and as a member of the Constitutional Committee and the National Executive of the African National Congress, took an active part in the negotiations which led to South Africa becoming a constitutional democracy. After the first democratic election in 1994, he was appointed by President Nelson Mandela to serve on the newly established Constitutional Court. Albie Sachs has been a visitor here at the University of Chicago a number of times in the last decade. I think this is at least your fourth or fifth speech. He has done talks for the Human Rights Program, participated in conferences at the law school, and is a well-beloved and respected member of our community, even though he lives very far away. And we're very pleased that we'll be able to welcome you to campus next winter to teach a course in the college. So without further introductions, Albie Sachs. Justice Sachs will speak for about a half an hour, and we will have time for questions afterwards.
I think it was about a week before the marvelous first democratic elections in South Africa, where we voted together, black and white, as equals for our first democratically elected parliament. And there's a conference on the law of the child. It was very well attended, and we had people from all over South Africa, many law faculties, and also a very distinguished professor of child law from Northwestern University called Bernardine Dorn. It was a very ebullient time. I guess you guys know a little bit what it's like when something that seemed totally impossible happens. And to speak about the rights of the child, our country was like a child, our constitution was like a child, our democracy was like a child, it just seemed so constant and so right. And I was quite buoyed up then, I remember, and I hadn't specialized in particular in dealing with children's law, but I felt we've really got to establish the rights of the child, put it on the map. And I felt a little bit frustrated by the rather narrow approach that people were adopting to children's rights. The right not to be abused, the right to a name. Important, of course it's important, fundamental. But surely there was something more profound, something more brilliant, something more buoyant, uplifting in relation to the rights of the child. And I came up with the idea of three clusters of children's rights. The right to protection in the most elementary form of little human beings who are the most vulnerable. But it must be more than that. The second cluster, the right to nutrition, to education, to health. And people were beginning to write about the children's rights of access to all these things. And then I felt there was something missing. A right to happiness, to adventure, to exploration, to growth, to know about your body, yourself, about the world. The right to dare life, to hope. Such an important cluster of rights, envisaging the child as a little burgeoning individual, and thinking in relation to our country how unequal those rights have been. The child abuse you can get in any section of society, and clearly there was massive inequality in relation to access to food and to water and to education and to health. But perhaps the most dampening of all was the frustration of dreams, of possibilities, of telling the great majority of South African children, you're black, you're excluded, you can't imagine yourself becoming a this or that or the other, and going out into the world. And I would just have this vision of all our children now being able to climb the mountains and to travel around the country and to go camping and just to do fun things like that, to take it for granted and to imagine one day when I grow up I can be a scientist or I can sail around the world or I can fly a kite. So that was the Ibalian Albi, 1994. I'd just resigned from the National Executive of the ANC. We were about to have elections. I wanted to be considered as a judge. And just felt it's important. I can't have two loyalties, to a political party and to the constitution at the same time. The thoughts that I had then and the outcome of a case that we had 2 years ago dealing with the rights of the child, we call her M. And M had used her credit card recklessly. She didn't have funds. She went from one store to another. The amounts involved weren't enormous. It was something like 44 counts of false use, fraudulent use of the card, amounting to maybe $500 or more. Not huge amounts, but over a couple of weeks. And the problem was she'd done it before, and she was actually out on bail for having done it. And she'd had a suspended sentence previous time. So now she's headed for jail. She's got three teenager sons. She lives in what the papers call a very fragile social environment. By all accounts, she's a good mother, a useful mother. And the case comes to us. She appealed to the High Court, and they reduced the sentence. They felt that for technical reasons, one of the charges had to be dropped. But she was sent to jail. It was for 4 years, with the possibility of being released early to do community service. She resisted going to jail. She desperately wanted to stay out of jail, even if it was 3 or 4 or 5 months. And the application came to us. We had to consider it. And it was based on the rights of the children. If she'd been a single person, it would have been a hopeless case. We would have said there's no constitutional issue. And we would have rejected the application. And one of my colleagues felt very, very strongly about this. And she said, you know, Albie, this is a chance for us to look at the rights of the child enshrined in our constitution as an independent factor to be taken account of. Normally, when it comes to sentencing, the sentencing judge will look at the severity of the crime, will look at the personality, personal circumstances of the accused, and the general community interest. And now the question was, is there a fourth dimension where the person being sentenced is the primary caregiver? And we had argument on that particular issue. I won't tell you what the outcome was yet. That will come at the end of my presentation. But the presentation really is about what I call the strange alchemy of life and law. To what extent do your experiences out there in the world, not sitting as a judge, influence the decisions you give when you are fulfilling your oath of office to do justice without fear, favor, or prejudice? Are we simply people with our own subjective predilections, feelings about the world, which you wrap up in legal language, as some legal scholars say? Are we simply rational automatons applying legal logic to factual situations without anything of our life experiences playing any role at all? Or is there something different that's happening? Is there a strange alchemy, I call it, between the things that shape our consciences, our vision of the world, our philosophy, our sense of who we are, what the laws are about, what the law means, why we have a constitution, what the constitution means for people living in our country? To what extent does that feed into, and how does it feed into, the decisions that we give, which are reasoned decisions laid out in, you call it our judgment, you call it your opinions here? That's the problem I posed when I was a Ford Foundation scholar in residence last year, working on several themes. I'm going to give you some examples, other than the one I've just given you, of intense life experiences and then how they play themselves out, work through in actual decisions. And these are just summaries, it's a preview, it's a foretaste, if you like, of the course that I'm thinking of giving when I come here next year. Oxford University Press are publishing the book. The book will be out, the book will serve as a basis for the course. Torture. Remember when I came here last year and there was a conference on torture, and I almost couldn't participate because when I walked into the lecture room, somebody was analyzing the costs and losses, cost-benefit analysis of torture. And do you lose more by torturing people than you gain? I think he actually came out saying, in general terms, you do lose more than you gain. I was horrified. Torture, something that rips at the heart of people's souls, the society that does it. I said, you can't have this conference in Chile or Argentina or in South Africa. You couldn't have a conference on torture like that. he couldn't torture his daughter. It's an abomination. It's ugly. You don't do it. There might be some arguments about the exact limits when something is permissible interrogation and it's torture. But the idea of saying that torture is permissible because there's a bomb ticking and the benefits outweigh it, just unthinkable. And I went back to our experience, living in exile. And I'm summoned by Oliver Tambo, the president of the ANC, to Lusaka. I'm working in Mozambique. He says there's something important he wants to discuss. All the formalities, how you're doing, the work, very African style, is very courteous, very beautiful delicacies of speech and connection. And then he says, we've encountered a very difficult situation in the ANC. We don't have anything in our constitution and our statutes that deal with what we do with persons who've been sent to destroy the organization when we hold it in captivity. There's no regulatory regime at all. The constitution deals with annual general meetings and the president and the deputy president and the aims and objects and the fee that you pay to join. Well, ordinary political organizations hopefully don't deal with what you do with captives. And he said it must be very difficult to establish the principles. So in my rather cocky lawyer's way, I said, well, it's not difficult. They're international standards. No torture, inhuman, degrading punishment or treatment. He said we use torture. He said with a bleak face. I almost collapsed. The ANC fighting for freedom, we use torture. He didn't explain the circumstances. I discovered years afterwards that Pretoria had sent agents to destroy the organization, to blow up people like me. It wasn't just a mythical thing putting down dissidents, to sabotage in all sorts of ways. And they'd been caught, or people suspected of that. And it turned out they were being treated in very, very rough fashion. They were being beaten up. He got to hear of it. He sent people to inquire. They got evidence that this was happening. And now he wanted to have regulations to prevent these things from happening again. And the question cropped up in the midst of our struggle. It was a very difficult struggle. We were being killed. We were being attacked. We were being isolated in every possible way. Is it permissible to use torture to find out who had sent them, who their contacts were, how they were planning to assassinate the leadership? We had a conference in which that was one of the key issues. And I still remember a couple of hundred of us in a little town called Kabwe in Zambia, with Zambian troops surrounding us in case South African commanders came to take out the whole of the ANC. And we had a code of conduct that I helped to draft. And the one tricky issue was, is it possible to use what was called intensive methods of interrogation in special circumstances? And I still remember so vividly the young soldiers of the ANC, the army of the ANC, going up and saying, we are fighting for life. How can we abominate life? And saying, no exceptions at all. Denouncing torture completely. And making us appreciate this is why we were risking our lives. Because we were fighting for something valuable and significant. This is what gave us a sense of solidarity and community. And if we became like the regime we were fighting, if we became like apartheid, then what separated us? What made it worthwhile? Then we might as well join, take the jobs that apartheid had to offer. It was a distinguishing feature. It was part of our personality, of our soul, of who we were, what made us freedom fighters. And they absolutely denounced torture, whatever the circumstances. whoever the people were who were captured. It was one of the most remarkable and moving moments in my life because it was so easy for me. All the time I felt I'm a lawyer, I belong to a different kind of a culture, it's okay for me, I'm not in the front line in the same way. To hear this from people who were literally risking their lives for your time was intensely moving. And that was one reason why we kept together as a liberation struggle, as a freedom movement, and why we got a constitution that forbids torture, and why we have a constitution that has a Bill of Rights as one of the central features of the constitution, because we fought these questions of who we were and core morality of who we were in the most difficult circumstances before we came to sit around the table and negotiate and discuss. So years later, I'm sitting on the bench and we have the case of Dr. Beth. That was the public description given. Who had been in the bacteriological and chemical weapons section of the South African military during the late apartheid period. And allegations that he had injected captured prisoners in Namibia, then called Southwest Africa, paralyzing them. They were taken in planes and dropped into the sea. Exactly the stories you hear from the Argentine, a kind of terrible internationalism, ways of getting rid of people, the sharks eat the bodies, they just disappear. It's hardly impossible to imagine a worse kind of crime for a medical doctor to commit. And he's charged with this. And the case comes to our courts, there are all sorts of technical issues involved. It had been thrown out technical grounds in the lower courts, and I write a judgment supporting the issue of is it a constitutional matter or not. If it's just an ordinary case, it doesn't come to our court. However much you might disagree with the outcome, but I argue war crimes are involved. We have a duty as a state to prosecute war crimes. It goes beyond the ordinary murder case, and it is a constitutional matter. But the judgment ends with saying the fact that he's charged with the most horrendous crimes does not relieve the prosecution from following due process of law. At the heart of our Bill of Rights is respect for human dignity. You saw it beautifully represented by my colleagues in the film, Human Dignity. And it's human dignity that requires war criminals to be prosecuted. But it's also human dignity that requires no one is guilty unless proven in a proper court of law through properly induced evidence, subject to the usual challenges and control, that they are guilty. There isn't an incompatibility between the right to a fair trial and denouncing and prosecuting horrible deeds. On the contrary, both derive from the same elementary principle. I'm going to say to move to a lighter theme, laughter. Does the law have a sense of humor? It cropped up in a case which I referred to. But the life experience was, it was funny and it wasn't funny. I'd been blown up by the bomb. I heard a voice in the darkness. I thought I was being kidnapped. I was fainting and coming to again. And the voice says, in Portuguese, Albi, you're in Maputo Central Hospital. This is Ivo Rodrigo speaking. Your arm is in lamentable condition. You have to face the future with courage. And I said, what happened? Total darkness, and a woman's voice said, there was a car bomb. And I fainted into happiness because I knew I was safe. darkness, 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 and suddenly I'm awake. And I feel my body, and I tell myself a joke. And the joke, those of you who heard me speak will have heard it, others might have heard it elsewhere, it's an old joke. Jaime Kahn falls off a bus, and he gets up and he does this, and someone said, Jaime, I didn't know you're Catholic. And he says, what do you mean Catholic? Spectacles, testicles, wallet, and watch. So, I'm laughing away, I'm feeling euphoric, in the darkness, I can't see. And I start with testicles, all in order. Say when I told the joke afterwards, the word went round to ANC camps, and I've tried very hard to be macho and haven't succeeded. But this joke raised my macho reputation enormously. And the first thing Comrade Albi did was reach for his balls. Said to me, and again I faint, and again into happiness, because I know I've only lost an arm, I'm going to survive, I'm fine. I mention that because laughter played, and humour, such a big role in our struggle. Time passes, and we have the laugh it off pace. Graduate of the School of Journalism brings out t-shirts. He read Naomi Klein. And the t-shirts lampoon, they parody the logos of big companies in South Africa. Cultural jamming, it's called. And one of them was Carly Black Label, the beer. Do you get Carly beer in the US? No. It's a Dutch firm sold internationally. And they called it Carly Black Labor. 300 years of exploitation. And the other firms laughed, some of them bought the t-shirts, gave it to the employees, but the owners of Carling in Holland were not amused. They didn't find it funny. And the group was called Laugh It Off, took them to court and got an injunction against them. They had a few hundred t-shirts, but the costs of the litigation were very heavy. It was taken on appeal to our Supreme Court of Appeal, and they also didn't find it funny. And they said, you can criticize the labor policies of the firm as much as you like, but you can't use its logo. The logo is the property of the firm, and you can't use the logo of the firm to sell your t-shirts. It came to us. We unanimously decided that the freedom of speech interests outweigh the property interests. It didn't make. There was no proof of any dent in the earnings of Carly Black Label. I was dissatisfied with that rather technical response. Even if it had been shown that there was some damage, what the people were doing was challenging the power of branding. And in their papers, they said, for example, Nike. They used to say, buy Nike because it's made of durable material, it gives you spring, it makes you an excellent athlete. Now it's Nike, not yes you can, that's how they all said that. Just do it. Just do it. If it makes you Superman, Superwoman, Nike. So the branding goes to getting to the personality. It's got nothing to do with advertising the qualities of the product. It's what it boosts you to be. And it was a serious attempt, using laughter, to challenge the hegemony of advertising, branding, the colonizing of the minds, in a way that was meant to be funny, and people bought it on the, through the internet, and at some pubs, they sold a few hundred versions of the t-shirt. So I opened my concurring opinion, my concurring judgment, by saying, does the law have a sense of humor? And answered it by saying, yes. And not only does it have a sense of humor, that humor is important for democracy. It's not just a question of commerce and balancing our interests. We need our satirists, we need our parodists. And the whole point of parody is it does appropriate and mock. Otherwise, there's no parody. To say, well, look, the right left to the press misses the point completely. The parody takes the object and turns it around in a way you recognize and dislocate at the same time. And the strongest part of the judgment was the importance of humor for democracy. And if humor was part and parcel of our freedom struggle, surely it would be part and parcel of our freedom. And I might say that I wrote subsequently also the importance of civility for democracy. And one of the things that I most appreciated at the recent American elections was the exceptionally gracious speech made by Donald Kane, and the exceptionally gracious response. And even George W. Bush, who I don't think would have got huge approval rating in this audience, was gracious in the physical handover of his former home to the present incumbents. And these things are not just questions of good manners. It's the give and take, the resilience, the shock absorbers, if you like, of democracy that are involved. Same-sex marriages case. This was the one that actually put me on to the theme of the strange alchemy. 1991. I'm driving in Cape Town, November, it's summer, and I'm sweating. I'm sweating because I'm driving almost for the first time with one hand. I'm sweating because I've been in exile for 24 years. I don't know the streets of Cape Town really well. I'm sweating because I was told to meet everybody at the usual meeting place, and I'm the big freedom fighter. I don't even know where the usual meeting place is. I'm sweating because I'm late, but I'm sweating because I'm going to go on a gay pride march. And I'm late, and I know they're thinking he's backing out. And I'm saying, oh, if only they could have a poster that says Straight for Gays, if only. And then I see them marching towards me. And the first poster I see says, suck, don't swallow. Oh my God. I'm going to be in the Cape Times newspaper tomorrow morning. I find somewhere to park the car. I was much weaker then than I am now. It was only a couple of years after the bomb. And I push and lumber along to join. And I'm next to Edwin Cameron, professor of law, really active in gay movement then, and I feel fantastic. Just one of those beautiful moments in my life where I feel I've crossed over, just something in me. I feel my pride that I'm marching together with the gay pride marchers. That's the first. And I make a little speech afterwards. In a park where I used to play as a child, and I said there were signs that said white only, there could have been signs that said straight only. It was a form of exclusion, so that people could cuddle and hold hands and be intimate with each other if they were opposite sex, but if they were the same sex. And the importance of the question of non-discrimination around sexual orientation went well beyond simply a section of the community that had been persecuted and harassed in the past. Because we are a country of different people. And difference in South Africa being the foundation, the weapon, the instrument used to maintain apartheid. We are different, we can't live together as equals in one country because we are different. And if we can't handle difference and deal with difference, very finished as a pantry. So the relevance of the theme went well beyond simply securing justice for a section of the community. Many years later, I'm a judge on the Constitutional Court, and the Chief Justice says, there's going to be, during our recess, a meeting of Christian Lawyers for Africa. And they invited him to attend. He said, he's going away at the time. Is there anybody who's available? I very tentatively put up my hand and say, well, I'm available. I don't think I'm the right person. He said, how are you just the right person? Now, Pius Lunga, you saw him on the screen. He's Christian, he's a lawyer, he's from Africa. But he didn't want to go in that capacity. That's a sectarian connection. So he felt I was just the right person. And not long afterwards, I'm driving, it's at night, it's cool, I'm not sweating, but I'm feeling very awkward. I grew up in a strict, strong, non-believing home. My parents had fought their parents. It was a matter of deep principle for them. And I had so many battles as a kid deciding and feeling that I can't dishonor myself and dishonor God if God exists by pretending a belief that I don't have. It's quite tough on a little kid wrestling with these things, but I think my whole conscience as a human being was shaped by that, more than by race, because my mother worked for an African leader. Race was just ridiculous. But here I had to make very deep personal decisions and choices. And now I'm going to speak to people who are people of faith, and they've come on that basis, and I can't just say welcome. So I decide to tell them the story, and the story is taking the oath when I was sworn in as a judge. And one by one, I was alphabetically challenged. I was the last. I see my colleagues and a couple of firm, most raise their right arms and say so. And I tell the Christian Lawyers for Africa the story about the battles that I had and growing up. I'm not a believer. But I said, when it came to taking the oath, eventually, I wanted to take the most solemn oath I could to all those who died and previously been tortured to death, assassinated. That was the oath that would bind me in my work as a judge. And I said, to do that, I had to raise my right arm, not just say I affirm. So I raised my right arm and said, so help me God. They stood up, they gave me a standing ovation. I was amazed. I said, I'm an unbeliever. They gave me this evaluation. The next day they came to the court. I did a tour. You saw that marvelous building. And I'm about to leave to go to another meeting. And they say, and I'm late. And they say, we must say a prayer. And there's some prayers that last, you know, truly thankful. Amen. This was a prayer that went around the world a few times. And now I'm about to leave. And I'm quite moved by this, because these are people of faith invoking something, honoring me in their way, even though they know I'm not a believer. And I can't accept the faith dimension of it, but I can accept the emotion, the spirituality, the meaning. And I'm about to leave, and they say, everyone's lay on hands. 70 people laying on hands, that kept me another couple of minutes. And then eventually I ran away. The same-sex marriages case, I'm asked to write the lead judgment. And I see these, I'm not consciously thinking of it at all. I've forgotten both the Gay Pride March and those of Africa. But I'm aware there's a world out there of South Africans, probably the great majority, opposed to the idea of same-sex marriages. On the other hand, everything I'd thought about sexual orientation, discriminating against people for being who they are, was so demeaning of our whole constitutional order. At the core of the judgment, the hardest part to write was the connection between the sacred and the secular. And I found it would not be right to simply divide the world into the enlightened and the benighted. The enlightened, us three, emancipated people, saying, of course, equality for everybody, and the rest of humanity, they're bigoted, they're backward, and so on. That's the way they see the world. But they can't allow their belief, their faith, to impose their vision through state mechanisms on others, to deny others their fundamental rights. And to my mind, religion, and I speak as a non-believer, is part of public life. It's not just a private thing that you do on your own on Sunday or Saturday or Friday or any other day it might be. It's part and parcel of the temper of society. It has enormous meaning for millions and millions of people. And not to recognize that as a fact of public life without allowing religious beliefs to impose on others, to dominate others, to deny others. And it's interesting here in the presidential speech where non-believers were included as having an important faith, an important set of beliefs. Non-believers, I felt was incorrect. And it worried me that I see the US Supreme Court, which I admire very, very much, whoever might be in the ascendancy in terms of outlook in any particular time, that the consequences of decisions here often divide the society down the middle. And one dreams of and hopes for the decisions of the court to find a sense of common ground that cuts across these divisions and brings and heals the nation and helps integrate the nation, with each respecting the outcome because they feel they are recognized, and not dividing the nation into the patriotic, some people might say, true believers of constitutions on the one hand, and the others would say the enlightened, the progressive, the humanitarian on the other. It's a complicated thing, but that divided experience forced me to convert what would have been a book of essays on different themes into the one continuing theme, the strange alchemy of life and law. So to conclude, the children's case. I'm eating up a little bit of the question time. I'll be here for 5 weeks next year. Loads of questions. All the judges on our court decided that the sentencing court had committed a significant misdirection in not inquiring into what would happen to the three children. There was a perfunctory question about how there were other relatives. And we said that's not enough. When there are minor children who will be directly affected by imprisonment of the primary caregiver, the court is under a duty in terms of our constitution, which says in any question involving the interests of the child, the child's interest shall be paramount. It doesn't mean she can't go to jail, but it means if she goes to jail, there has to be a separate special inquiry of what happened to the children. And the idea of taking them into care, disrupting the familial setup, when now 5 years had passed, she'd been earning well, she was active in the Parent and Teachers Association, she not only, as it were, gone straight, but she was showing that she had capacity to be a decent member of the community, we decided community service was something better for the community. She must repay the people whom she robbed. She must do some useful kind of work. She must get some form of counseling and therapy, but that would be in the interest of the children, of herself, and of the community, rather than sending her to jail, which would appear to be symbolically very powerful, but would be very destructive. And there's a lot of discussion about restorative justice. Last week, we got a new member of our court. His name's Edwin Cameron, the guy I marched next to. A brilliant lawyer, a very strong member of the court. Four of us have to retire, leave the court in October this year, the original members of the court. And it's good to know that we've got somebody of his caliber there who was public about his sexual orientation early on. And when he was put onto the court, the High Court for the first time, stated he felt it was only fair to state that he was living with HIV. One of the first public figures in South Africa to do that. So he's got great moral caliber, intellectual quality, outstanding. And he said he's new on the court, and he met somebody, a young person in Oxford, whom he'd like to have as an intern for 2 months in June, July. This person isn't fully qualified as a lawyer yet, and he can't do the ordinary term, is there some way of getting him to come? And this person's name is Cheza Boudin. Cheza Boudin was adopted by Bernadine Dorn and her husband Villers when their mother went to jail. Kathy Boudin has come out of jail. She's on probation. She visited our court after 21 years. It was very redemptive. It was very marvelous for her to see a court built in the heart of a prison stand for human rights. And I didn't know at the time. I had nothing to do with Cheza being selected. Edmund just said he's a very remarkable young man. So I think it's a fitting kind of conclusion to that connection with Bernadine very early on. Cheza was a Rhodes Scholar even when his mother was in prison. I think the New York Times had quite a good article about it. I'm looking forward very much to meeting him. And I feel it's a lovely connection with Chicago, so I can't wait for him to come. Thank you.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about human rights as a perception of human rights as a priority in South Africa, both now, since apartheid, changes in your generation, changes in my generation, and also the sort of intensification of the crisis in Zimbabwe and how that might be affecting things.
Sorry, what's the question?
How human rights have changed in terms of public sense of human rights as a priority. That are non-theist. What's the root? How do you get those?
Thank you again for coming. This is a current events question. I was wondering what your perceptions are about the splitting of the ANC and COPE, and what it's like in South Africa now. What's the word on the street?
I guess my question is more about rhetoric, and I'm curious about how your ideas about the language in the Constitution have changed since your involvement in the struggle when a lot of those words were being used and mobilized for political reasons.
The question of culture and religion actually cropped up very pertinently in the case of, I'm trying to remember her first name, Ms. Pillay, who was a student in Durban Girls High School, which was one of the top public schools for white girls in Durban, until democracy came. Now it's roughly a third white, a third people of Indian origin, a third people of Black African origin. And she wanted to wear a nose stud, just a little jewel, because she was Tamil. Her mother felt very strongly about it. And she said it's part of her culture and her religion. And the school said, sorry, but if you wear a nose stud, we have a jewelry control in the school disciplinary code. We don't want the rich girls to flaunt their jewels. We don't want people to be aping Britney Spears when they should be thinking about mathematics. And you can wear your stud outside school, that's fine, but not in school. It's against our code, which only permits simple studs in the ears. And she went to the Equality Court, and the Equality Court said, well, it's not unreasonable, it's not unfair school of thought about the matter. They consulted with another. They've spoken to people from the Tamil community who said there's nothing in the Tamil religion as such that says you can't wear, that you have to wear a nose guard. It went to the High Court, and the High Court said no, that this was part of the identity of a section of the community. It was connected with the racism of the past, and that you should be allowed to wear. And the matter came to us. And one of the main arguments was, is this just a cultural practice, or is it a religious practice? And the evidence we had showed you couldn't separate the two. It was connected with religion, but it wasn't part of an actual religious ceremony. It was very much cultural, but it had a mystical, historical, spiritual kind of a meaning. And we said it didn't really matter because there's an overlap between culture and religion, and was this unfair discrimination. The fact that girls who didn't share her beliefs and didn't have a background couldn't wear the nose guards, that wasn't unfair to them. That wasn't a denial of equality. Equality was allowing people to adorn themselves in terms that their culture and religion allowed. That would be the equal rights for everybody. And so we upheld the claim. And there's quite extensive writing on culture and religion in that particular judgment. So I forget who your friend was. I'm not quite sure what the purpose was of the question or why he asked. But questions of circumcision come in. There are quite a few areas where religious practices, cultural practices sort of overlap. And I don't think the neat classification is what really matters. It's the extent to which human dignity and the right to be different, the right to be who you are, comes into play. The intensity of it, the significance of it. And this was clearly very significant for her. She was prepared to be expelled from the school for the sake of defending her claims. The evolving attitude to human rights. The very first case we had dealt with capital punishment, we saw that on the film. And the court said that a society that respects human rights, that has the Bill of Rights that we have, can't allow the state deliberately, coldly, and calculated way to take the life of its citizens. That's diminishing respect for human rights. It's an inhuman act in itself. And I'm sure all of us were influenced by the extent to which, under apartheid, the state had wantonly disregarded the lives of our people and saw that the way to maintain social order was by killing rather than through the kinds of means that we felt appropriate. And we said there was no proof that the serious threat of being captured, prosecuted, and sent to jail for a long, long period, there was any less of a deterrent than the threat of capital punishment and all the evidence that we had. We quoted quite extensively from American jurisprudence, mainly finding that the writings of the judges in the minority expressed what we in our constitution, at any rate, felt was most appropriate. We weren't looking for precedent, we were looking for philosophy, outlook that was compatible with our view of life. That was an early case, and it established the court as being serious about human rights, because you're serious when you take up the difficult cases. You're not serious when you take up the easy cases. I mean, that's important that you do that. But I'd like to feel we got a lot of respect from the public, that we weren't simply following public opinion. The job of the court in cases where deep values of this kind, central values about the capitalist society are involved, then the court is there to defend the most unpopular, and few people can be less popular than those found guilty of these terrible crimes. So we took that stand, and we've tried to be consistent all the way through. When it came to the same-sex marriages case, the judgment for the court, only one judge dissented, Kate O'Regan, who we saw speak about the library. She said the court should immediately change the law, write in words into the statute, change the common law. The rest of us felt that we should refer the matter to Parliament, a matter of such grave sensitivity, Parliament had the same duty as we as a court had to uphold fundamental rights. Our constitution expressly forbids discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. And so we said Parliament must find the proper legal modality to achieve that. And we won't do it, because there are many different ways it could be done, provided you don't go in for separate but equal. Separate but equal means, you're not good enough, you don't belong, you're different. Somehow, if we marry you, we are tarnishing the institution of marriage. And that's very, very demeaning and very, very undignified to the people concerned. In the end, Parliament, after a year, came up with the formula of a civil union act. But the civil union allows the partners to say, I marry you. And it's actually very moving when not long afterwards, just a couple of weeks afterwards, I went to Kirstenbosch, which is a very beautiful, salubrious part where you take your ailing mother for tea and scones. Nothing could be more family-oriented than Kirstenbosch. And I'm looking for the place where I'm going to a particular reception, and the sign says, Amy and Jean's wedding. And the arrow points to a particular place where we had to go. It was so normal and so wonderful. And Amy and Jean were amongst the first. Amy being American, Jean being South African, they went back there and they got married. And it was very moving, very, very lovely for me to feel how normal and straightforward it had been, and no walls came tumbling down, and our society is carrying on. The fact is that there wasn't a huge outcry. There was campaigning against the same-sex marriages, but the human rights theme in the end dominated. One of the persons who spoke out very, very strongly was Deborah McCarter, who's one of the leaders of the new organization, CODE. That's to his eternal credit, that he said we were fighting for human rights and we must defend human rights, we as the ANC. I can't say anything about ANC and CODE. These issues might come to the court. I'm a judge and I have to refrain completely. The question of rhetoric I deal with in the book in a slightly different connection, and I think I have to end my presentation with this, where I deal with why it's so difficult to write a judgment. Surely you've got the principles of the law, you have the facts, you apply the principles to the fact, and the result comes out. And yet we judges disagree. And we're all clever people, otherwise we wouldn't be judges. We're pretty learned, we debate, we argue, why is it so difficult? And I came to the conclusion, well, not to the conclusion, that every judgment I write is a lie, because it pretends that it grows itself in that simple way. A, B, C, D, E. Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock. And in fact, it's written tock, tick, tick, tock, 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 tick, tick. Backwards and forwards, we debate, we argue, we cut out bits. And I got the explanation from political scientists who said it's the difference between the logic of justification and the logic of discovery. And justification is rational, it obeys certain laws of reason, it's imperative, those are the rules. But discovery is a totally different process. And my biggest discoveries came when I was lying inert in the bath, in the bathtub, not thinking at all, not reasoning, but I'd spent months on the issue and suddenly solutions sprang, they just came out. I think the book's called Blink came out in the United States not too long ago, bringing out that point. And so legal judgments involve discovery and justification, but I said they also involve rhetoric. Rhetoric is the persuasiveness, the images you use, the examples, the points of reference, the references from history, from our past, things that will persuade. They don't add to the logic. The logic is pure reason. They don't add to the discovery, you've already made it. But the rhetoric is what provides that kind of argumentation that is convincing. And finally, I say there's a fourth character called Preening, a little bit of judicial show-off. It gives a certain timbre, a certain quality that makes it interesting to read, whether it's by yourself or by somebody else. So that's all I can say about the rhetoric. It's a whole enormous area, and it's been a great pleasure. If I might say so, I think launching the Persian visiting professorship, giving a little bit of an antipasto, meeting with yourselves. Thank you.